Hello, I'm Mark Steiner.
And I'm Anthony McCarthy.
And we are switching gears?
A little bit.
From national to local?
That's right. Very important issue.
There have been 10 police shootings this year. Not of policemen, police shooting citizens. 8 have been killed. We're going to talk about that with our police department and with community activists in a little bit as well. First, we turn this over to WEA Traffic Check on the Roads and come right back to our conversation. So please stay with us.
Support for WEAA is provided by Mini, featuring the Mini Hardtop. Information at your Baltimore Annapolis Mini dealer.
The biggest problem this afternoon has been just below the area. Good afternoon. Garmin gives you the very latest. We're seeing improvement 95 South, which was shut down at 212 for about 2 or 3 hours. Looks like there's 2 right lanes blocked there, but traffic's no longer being detoured onto 198. You're still going to find brake lights into 216. Northbound slows down to take a look, and it's just volume heavy all by itself. Beltway delays crop up right on time. The Interloop seeing speeds down off and on 40 to Liberty with more brake lights. Green Spring to the JFX, and up top there's gridlock from Charles in towards Perrin Parkway, also along the inner loop. Looks like things now get sluggish. 95 North in between 175 and 100, again at the Fort McHenry, and again at the Pulaski Highway, all the way up in towards 695 in the northeast corner. Southbound 895 slows in towards the Harbor Tunnel out to Poteet because of the work zone at the Steel Bridge. For more information, log on to SigAlert.com. Liz Drabik, Baltimore Area Traffic.
Hello, I'm Mark Steiner.
And I'm Anthony McCarthy.
And we're here to have a conversation about the police in Baltimore City, about the shootings and killings in the city. This time we're going to talk about the number of shootings by police officers of Baltimore citizens and why that's going on and why the number is so high and what has been happening and issues around that. Before we jump into that conversation, I want to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is a credit union, not just a bank. It belongs to you. Money comes back in the end. No interest on your bank account. For more information, www.mecu.com is the place to go. You also can go to steinershow.org and click on their banner. Anthony and I are joined right now by the spokesman for the Baltimore City Police Department, Anthony Guglielmi. And Anthony, welcome. Good to have you with us once again.
Hi, Mark. Hi, Anthony. How are you guys?
Hey, Anthony.
410-319-8888 is the number here to join us. So welcome. Let's start in. First of all, I'm glad to see you sticking around between commissioners. We'll begin with your response to what the public really has been wanting to know, which is why there have been so many police shootings from your perspective.
You know, Mark, the last thing that any police officer wants to do is utilize his service weapon. The decision to use your weapon is made truly in life or death situations. When a police officer feels that his safety or the safety of a citizen is compromised, you know, beyond a level that can be recovered from, that's when they engage in deadly pursuit. You know, there's a whole level of training, a whole checklist on when officers use deadly force. There's a use of force continuum that that they go by. And again, it's truly when these individuals fear that their life or the life of another is placed in jeopardy. And so far this year, Mark, we're at about 10 police-involved shootings. That's about the number that we had last year. I think total number last year for incidents was 9, if you count the tragedy at the Select Lounge. The number of victims in that case was obviously higher. There were multiple people that were shot. But, it's a little bit of a change. Back in 2007, you had 32 police-involved shootings in Baltimore. You had 21 in 2008, 22 in 2009. And it was at that point that Commissioner Bielefeld made a very conscientious decision in rethinking the way we train at the BPD. And what we knew was that the majority of police-involved shooting cases in previous years involved struggles with officers' own weapons. So we engaged in very specialized training over at the police academy. We invested in technology, the use of tasers and other non-lethal devices that police officers use. And we've seen the number of police shootings come down. And that's kind of where we are right now.
So, Anthony, this is Anthony McCarthy. I just want to ask you, because I think there is a perception issue in the community, and I'm wondering how we can improve that perception, because I'm sure you hear it, certainly on the ground where you are every day, you hear it from both perspectives and certainly on both sides, not that we're choosing sides, but there is a perception that there are more police-involved shootings than what people have grown to, I don't want to say expect, because we certainly don't want to expect any, but you've just laid out the context for where that is just simply not true. But in the public's eye, I will tell you, the calls that I get, I know that Mark get, from families that are involved in these shootings, there is almost always part of that conversation is that they've done it again, that there is a perception in this community that guns are pulled quickly. And the result of that is someone loses their son, their daughter. And I understand the other side of that, where an officer feels that he is at risk. What can we do to communicate better where we find ourselves in these police-involved shootings?
You know, Anthony, we see this in not just police-involved shootings, but the issue of perception versus reality. And, you know, Commissioner Bielefeld used to frustrate himself at how can we communicate to the city that we are truly getting safer. And he's been on Mark's show, he's been on a ton of shows. People just didn't feel like the city was getting safer, but the data clearly showed that we've had less people murdered in the city, less people were getting robbed, and the numbers were truly trending downward. That doesn't mean that we were out of the woods. We still had a ton of work to do, but we truly were getting safer, and we got frustrated because the perception lagged far behind of that. And I think with police-involved shootings, here we find ourselves in the same situation. I mean, I looked at the numbers prior to picking up the phone, and you know, we're at half of what we were just 3 years ago, and you know, that's a real testament to the level of training. It's a testament to the work that these officers do. And again, please, don't misunderstand me here. No police officer, whether you're in Baltimore or Boston, wants to use a service weapon. It's truly used in a life or death situation when there truly is no other resort or no other choice. And you know, I have to be very careful about what I say, because there are investigations that are ongoing for a couple cases, but what I think people need to know is what happens. How are these things investigated? And let me just bring everybody up to speed. So you have a police-involved shooting. We reformed the way we look at them ever since the Select Lounge. Everyone knows we brought in a national panel of experts to look at how we respond after police-involved shootings, how can we better investigate. And I think that now we probably have a national standard in how shootings are investigated. Immediately after the shooting, just with the case this last Saturday, homicide detectives respond. They conduct a criminal investigation into the incident, and they're looking. They're calling balls and strikes. They're looking for facts, and they're handling it just like they would any other criminal investigation.
Well, I guess one of the things, Anthony, that I think that people are looking for, because I mean, I don't know a lot about any of these particular shootings. I wasn't there for any of them.
Sure.
I've only talked to some people around in the neighborhoods, and you get people have their own impressions, like they did about the killing of Rudy Bell Sr., who was allegedly schizophrenic. The arguments, nobody really knows what happened. An officer was cut. Was he cut during, after? How did it happen? Nobody really knows. But there are people saying that he's a guy who could have been subdued another way. He could have been tasered. He could have been maced. He could have been stopped in some other way other than and as police have said on here before, as a former state police major who now runs a Hopkins leadership program, you know, that we're trained to try to disarm people with knives without shooting them. There's not always necessary to shoot somebody. So, I mean, the question is, people really don't trust the response of the police department. So one of the things that people are asking for perhaps is we need some kind of review board that oversees this, that is a civilian review board, not just made up of police, but people can look at this, they say, more objectively and decide whether or not certain things that happen in the police department are justified or not.
Sure, Mark. We have a level of that already. You have an impartial investigation and, prosecutorial review that is done by the state's attorney's office. And they will look at homicide's case. And, you know, Mr. Bernstein and his staff are going to call balls and strikes. They're going to say, this is what's permissible under the law, and this is what isn't. And that's the level of independent oversight that we incorporate into our investigation. In addition to the criminal piece, you still have an administrative investigation that's conducted by the Internal Affairs Section. And Chief Braylon Williams, he runs IA ever since he came on about a year ago. And, you know, Braylon calls balls and strikes better than anybody else. He understands law enforcement. He's an Obama administration appointee. And he's, as Commissioner Bielefeld said, when he hired him, his charge is to hold officers accountable. So those are the three steps that we have for investigations. And when, you know, when officers do things that are improper, they're held accountable, whether it be in a criminal proceeding or administratively through internal affairs. The case of Mr. Bell, you know, I have to be careful again, Mark, it is still under investigation. We have an officer who sustained injuries, was cut on his face, and we're going to do whatever we can to make sure that our men and women go home safely to their families every night. That's one thing. When you attack a police officer with an edged weapon, whether in this case it be a knife or a bottle, you really don't leave yourself any room. You know, you've engaged him, you've threatened the life of that officer. It was the officer's partner that reacted swiftly in defense of his partner. And I think, you know, none of us were there, none of us know the exact situation, but it's very difficult to put ourselves in that position, you know, the next day or 2 days after the fact. So I think we have to give investigators the necessary space and time to conduct an impartial investigation and let the facts tell us what happened.
Let me open the phones here. There's some folks we want to raise some issues, and then before you have to leave, and I turn to our panel that's here in the studio, 410-319-8888. Hank, you're on the air.
Hello, how you doing today, Mr. Steiner?
Very well, Hank. Welcome to the show.
I am blessed, right? I'm opening up my feelings, to be honest and truthful, right? The number one reason I believe there's so many police involved is because there's almost no recourse for anything that happens to them. The most I've ever seen European officers do, I've seen maybe one European officer get locked up, three black officers get locked up, and everybody else get pretty much walk. So that's why we don't trust them, and we think that they shoot at us. And then you think about, you talking about the police officer's life being threatened. Our life is threatened by them. They come up to our cars with guns drawn and put it in our face, and that automatically intimidates us. Now, if we see them with their guns out first, if we had a chance to draw our guns, then it would be a whole different story. They would have to think about what they were doing next. They have no recourse. If they shoot somebody, they think automatically, because they are the biggest gang in the world, and this is, we talk about throughout the world, police stick together, right? Fraternal order police, whether you Chinese, Russian, or whatever, stick together. So if I do something wrong, you got my back. We are blood. We're not we're police, we're blue blood. And you supposed to stick with me and lie for me, because I would lie for you.
So Hank, you've laid a lot out there. Which how you feel this is going on? I'd like you to ask the Mr. Guglielmi, the spokesman for Baltimore City Police, the question you want to ask.
I'm asking. This is what I would like to know, right? Why is it you do not have people who are from our city police us? Who can police us better than us? A police officer, he don't have to necessarily live in Baltimore City. He can live in Baltimore County. But from Prince George's County, from Pennsylvania, from Virginia, these are people who do not know Baltimore or Merrill. I've had the same police that locked me up and said I was a gang member. I've seen get on one police, one guy, stop dealing with this guy, all because of a car rolled by him. Jump in his car and go pull up this guy in a gas station. And everybody get out the car and then proceeded to lock up a man who was handicapped.
All right, let me let Anthony come back and kind of, you heard some of the things that Hank was saying, who we know is a local cab driver.
Sure, Hank. I heard a lot of what you said, and you know, frankly, I don't know that there's a department in the region that holds itself accountable more than the Baltimore Police Department does. And I think whether it's internal investigations, even the tragedy involving former officer Haji Tshamba. Remember, it was the BPD that initiated that investigation. It was the BPD that held that individual accountable and charged him with murder. And, you know, between that, between all of the other things that we've done to demonstrate our commitment to the public, I just don't know that there's any other agency out there that's done more over the last 4 years than we have. It's something that we're truly committed to. And the second thing I'll say is, you're right. You're absolutely right. I mean, why don't citizens from Baltimore become police officers? Listen, we're hiring 300 positions in this year right now. So you tell your buddies, you tell your friends, pick up the phone, come down to police headquarters and apply for the job, because we are eager to have them join the crime fight in Baltimore.
Anthony, do you think that officers who live in Pennsylvania, who live in Virginia, who live outside of this jurisdiction, that they swear, and I've been at those ceremonies, and I believe there's a certain level of passion and sincerity in those officers' eyes and in their words when they take that oath to protect and serve the people of the city of Baltimore. But do you honestly believe, and I know you'll give an honest answer, would we be better off if we had officers who lived in this city, who became part of their neighborhood association, whose children were going to schools in this city? Would it be a different police force? Or is the training really just prepares them to police the city?
Anthony, I can say with absolute honesty that I think that these men and women of the BPD are one of the most bravest and committed police forces that I've ever worked with. They put their lives on the line every day for complete strangers that they don't even know. In just this last case, they respond to robbery calls, burglary calls, armed person calls. Every day, they put their lives on the line. And whether they live in Pennsylvania or Massachusetts or California, they come to work every day and they give us 110% of what they have. And I don't know that we can ask more of any individual. And I think as an organization, you want to open yourselves up so that you get the very best of talent out there. And if we have officers that live in other states that perform well and that serve the city great, then God bless them. They should be a part of our team.
Let's got to get another caller in here before we have to take a break and bring our other guests into the studio. Robert and Towson, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, Robert. Welcome.
All right. I just wanted to address, the police spokesperson. He never answered your question directly in terms of the non-lethal force that the police are allegedly trained in. It seems like they're always resorting to the lethal force as opposed to the non-lethal force. If they are trained to disarm someone, de-escalate someone, why is it when, they encounter those circumstances, the first resort is always to draw their weapon and to not just, to subdue the subject, but to actually just eliminate the subject, okay? No officer wants to go home. I mean, all officers want to go home at the end of the day. However, parents want to see their sons and daughters at the end of the day also, okay? And if this truly was a schizophrenic, individual, there should be training for these officers to encounter, when they encounter such individuals like that, they should recognize them. They should treat them as such, okay? They should also, take the appropriate force, okay? They're under no circumstance is it appropriate, okay, or acceptable to take someone's life, okay, because, you don't have any other option.
So Anthony Guglielmi, let you respond to him.
Sure, Mark. So, Robert, thanks for the question. We absolutely do. We absolutely are investing in tasers. We are investing in the training of tasers. And you should know that we use those devices regularly. We use those devices in situations when they're called for, but there are situations that occur that truly put the officer or an individual citizen's life in jeopardy. And at that point, the officer uses his training and discretion to utilize deadly force, and that's because he or she truly feels that his life is in imminent danger. And that's exactly the protocol that they're supposed to follow. And in cases where that protocol is not followed and poor judgment was used, then these individuals are held accountable. They're held accountable in a criminal court of law, and they're also held accountable internally. One thing that I can say, too, is we are continuing our investment into devices like tasers, and we're getting individuals trained. But taser is not always the answer. I mean, you are going to have situations where they rise above the use of a taser, and I think that's why we have to invest and constantly invest in training.
Anthony Guglielmi, spokesperson for the Baltimore City Police, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Mark.
Good to have you with us.
Take care.
We are now joined here in studio. Folks, we're going to get into your calls. We have an interesting panel here with us, so please stay with us. We'll get you out there and have your opinions heard and thought. And we're here with Dwight Pettit, a defense attorney who has represented clients in lawsuits against the police for many years and has been a community advocate in his own right. Dwight, good to have you in the studio once again.
My pleasure, Mark Anthony.
Ted Sutton's with us, a community activist. You've pastored the Maryland Church of God in Christ. And Ted, good to have you with us as well.
Good to be here, Mark.
Working in the streets, a lot of our kids who have been in gangs and people in trouble in our own communities. Justin Fenton is with us, crime reporter for the Baltimore Sun. Justin, welcome. Justin's out there yet? Okay, Justin will be here in a minute. And, of course, Anthony McCarthy is still here. So your initial thoughts, Dwight, before we go back to the phones.
Well, I have to disagree with just about everything that Mr. Giuliani stated. We are in a very, very dire, almost desperate situation in Baltimore where the police actually feel no accountability whatsoever for their actions. And I've been in practice here for 40 years, and I never intended to get this involved in something like police shootings, but it has been so exaggerated and so cumulative that seems to have changed or accelerated by 100% since I first started practicing law 40 years ago. And when you talk about the things that Mr. Giuliani talked about, the review board that they had in this city that they really don't have now, had no subpoena power, no enforcement power, and nothing. The state's attorney's office is a political office that doesn't really look in terms of police activity, in terms of accountability. And the internal investigation division of the police department is a sham. And so these police officers have no accountability. They face nothing. The city automatically defends and stands in their place. The police commissioner, the blue code, as one caller says, Eddie said, the blue blood running through their veins is to deny everything. The city, the administration, everybody protects them. And in most cases, what we find out, and I know you got to go to break, most of these officers, you would be surprised. Instead of them being admonished, instead of them being prosecuted, instead of them being disciplined, when we do these cases, we find that most of the time these shooters are promoted. I mean, it's unbelievable. I can go back to five or six cases that we've tried. The Hubbard case that we had with Billy Murphy and Johnny Cox, the officers were promoted. Case of Quarles that was shot down at Lexington Market that made national news. And it was on video across the nation. Those officers, in that case, he wasn't promoted, but he wasn't disciplined as a result of what he did. He was disciplined because he had shot at his wife months before and never taken off the force. So they finally disciplined him after that shooting. We have shootings now that Giuliana mentioned in terms of what's the club down at the Select Club. This investigation has drawn out for months and months. They call in some kind of an independent panel. Nothing has happened to those police officers. No information has been given to the public as to accountability. And we have one of the ladies in that case, an innocent bystander, that was shot. Not to talk about the fact the officer shot 12 to 20 times or something. So there's no accountability. And as long as there's no accountability, it's going to continue to get worse before it gets better. And these officers, Baltimore City Police Department, is totally out of control.
And Justin Fenton, welcome. Good to have you with us. A Sun reporter, crime reporter for the Baltimore Sun. Good to have you with us once again.
Hi there. I'm sorry I can't be in studio.
I'm sorry you can't be too, but it's good to have you with us. Before we turn to our other guest here, and Anthony leaps in with his thoughts, Justin, let me just ask this question. You've watched this. You have this log of these 10 people shot, and I'm just curious. You heard what Dwight Pettit just said. Are there questions that you think that whether it's we in the media or for the public have not answered or they have not answered for us in terms of what's behind these shootings, what's happened? Are the police really not being held accountable? I mean, what's your sense of it?
Well, I think that both Anthony and Dwight have both made great points. I mean, it's a real tough issue. You know, first of all, when an officer uses force like this, I mean, the standard for the prosecutors to bring charges is really, were they, you know, did they fear for their life? Now, it doesn't mean that fear was irrational. It means that they felt in fear for their life in that moment, and they're able to respond this way. So that's why you see very very rarely is anyone criminally charged. Now, take a step away from the criminal aspect of it. And, you know, a lot of people look at these instances and say, yeah, but was that right? And could it have gone down a different way? One of the things that's caught my eye about the shootings this year is that, you know, there's been 10 people shot, 8 of them fatally, and only one of them had a firearm. Now, that's significant because in previous years, almost everybody who was shot pulled a gun on a cop. And this year we've seen a lot of incidents where it's someone who has a knife or no weapon at all, and the situations are sort of escalating so much that it ends with someone losing their life. So I'm not sure what the answer is, but, you know, I sort of see both sides of the argument.
Let me ask you this, Dwight, and then Justin, ask you to chime in as well. But, Mr. Pettit, about this idea of training, and Anthony Guglielmi mentioned it several times, that they are utilizing training that really does give officers options. And he said these officers in these cases that this year, they don't, or any officer, they don't pull their weapon unless it's a last resort. What can we do, or what could we suggest when it comes to the training of these officers that would – because I think one part that Anthony missed, and I know that he didn't do it on purpose because I know him, is that this idea of the officer is significant. Their safety is significant. Their commitment to protecting our city and our streets significant. But we cannot downplay a mother who gets a call that says her child was shot by a police officer, or her husband is not coming home, or someone's mother is not coming home because of an interaction with a police officer. So this idea that there are options, well, I'm trying to figure out why these options aren't being employed. And is it really as simple as there's no accountability?
Well, I think we have to go back to no accountability. But, you know, Justin pointed out a very strong fact that I hadn't realized, that most of the shootings used to be arguable because there was a weapon involved, or even the case that you all were just talking about. Allegedly, there's a knife involved.
Mm-hmm.
But what we've seen over and over, a case that I'm trying right now in Baltimore City, right as I'm coming from court now, are involved shootings where the police don't look for any other options, or they discard any other potential options. And this thing of my life was in danger is a catch-all. When they have nothing else, then the next thing they insert, my life was in danger. Okay, he didn't have a gun. We tried one in Cherry Hill last year. We tried one up here by the Hunt Shopping Center. I mean, Mr. Hunt in the Northeast Shopping Center, where they had searched him back and forth, searched him for about 10 minutes, according to the witnesses, and let him go, and then claimed that he started to run and shot him in the back. And again, the same argument is made. He was turning. I thought I saw a weapon. I thought I have a gun. When they just searched him for 10 minutes and no, he didn't have a gun. So this catch-all of my life being threatened is really, it becomes comical after it's being inserted over and over. And I think Justin just make a heck of a head of a point. If it's moving to the point the shootings are taking place more now without weapons than were taking place years ago, when at least there was some physical, evidentiary, forensic threat to the officers. Now that those don't exist, then why is this deteriorating? It's only deteriorating not for the purpose of training, because, you know, that is something that is just a scapegoat out. It's deteriorating because there is no accountability. If there was some political accountability, enforcement accountability, some price you would have to pay, this would stop.
We have to take a brief break, and we'll come right back, and we'll go to we haven't heard yet from one of our guests here in the studio, Ted Sutton. We'll hear Ted Sutton's response to that, and Justin Fenton, and go right to the phones. Burness and Lakeisha, next two callers up. We'll get your calls in there as well, 410-319-8888. Stay with us as we look at police shootings in Baltimore City. Hello, I'm Anthony.
I don't know if that's so true. Well, I had to retract that one.
You're Anthony McCarthy.
I'm Anthony McCarthy. Okay. You're Mark Steiner.
I'm Mark Steiner. 410-319-8888 is never. That's very funny. And not a very funny subject, but that was very funny. We are joined here. You just heard Dwight Pettit, defense attorney, in the renowned defense attorney here in Baltimore City. Justin Fenton, crime reporter for the Baltimore Sun. Ted Sutton, our youth pastor at the Maryland Church of God in Christ, who runs houses for ex-gang members, other things in our communities. But I forgot we're also doing by Christian Williams. I apologize. Author of Our Enemies in Blue, Police and Power in America. Christian, good to have you with us as well. We're going to get you into this discussion here. But let's go around Robin to answer this question. If you wanted to quickly, Justin, respond to what we just raised, and then we'll go to Ted and bring Christian in.
Well, sure. I mean, one thing in fairness to the officers is that I've spoken with officers involved in some of these shootings, and they truly are, stunned. You know, they're often surprised at the outrage, because they see it as, you know, this person attacked me, this person was coming at me and could have grabbed my gun, could have stabbed me. You know, what do you expect me to do in that situation? And they say that they're surprised that people think that they sort of wanted to take a life. Some other things that I'm not sure Anthony mentioned when he was on. I missed the first 5 minutes. But one of the things that they've been doing since the Torbett shooting is doing reviews of every. They had not done for years, even though it's in the general orders, they had not done training reviews of shootings. They'd done the criminal review, then they hadn't actually analyzed it to see, well, did they follow the training though, and how can we avoid this? And one thing that review this year has found is that the majority of the officers involved in shootings did not have tasers available to them. They didn't have a less lethal option, so to speak. And so that's one positive thing that's come out of those reviews. The other thing is that they actually have been doing, since 2009, mandatory training, mental illness training, to sort of understand mental illness, to decrease officer injury, and de-escalate incidents. It just seems like in these incidents that training hasn't helped too much. So I just wanted to throw those things out in addition to the things I said earlier.
And I will say, go ahead, Ted. I won't say it now. Let Ted jump in and then go to Christian.
No, actually, it's just good to be here.
Good to have you here,
Ted. But one thing I will say, I'm concerned about the damage it's doing to the community and community relations with police officers. And the reason I say that is because I deal with a lot of young men, and a lot of them, Bloods, Crips, BGF, different things, and I'm trying to get them to change because I changed. The thing that I'm concerned with is when you put in the mind of a young black male that if I'm stopped, I will not get justice, or I do not have a fair chance, that's a very damaging image to put in these young people's minds. Because if that is the case, then I have to up front do whatever I'm going to do, meaning flight or fight. So I'm going to have to do something, and that's one of the things that I'm very concerned with. Why don't they have some of these seasoned officers be mentors to some of these young guys? And the guy hit it on the nose. There are so many. I've actually been a part of the training at the academy at different times where I've actually brought gang members into the police academy, and they tell those officers why they do not like the police. And as they start to begin to tell all of the times that they have been mistreated, see, and that's one of the parts that we have not heard. A lot of the portions that you have heard are the ones who actually, so-called, actually brought it to the surface. But the majority of the time, most of the people in the streets have kept the code to the streets, no snitching. So they don't tell when they have been victimized. And that's one of the issues that I'm concerned with, because I just got back from England in the same area where they started rioting. But as I had a chance to talk to them, the same young people who were friends of the young man who was killed by the police, they told me how the animosity against the police officers and society as a whole had been growing for almost a year. And that's when things just broke, and it was the last straw.
And I'm sorry, Chris Williams, glad you're with us, and who has written the book, Our Enemies in Blue, Police and Power in America. From a national perspective, respond to the things you've heard here in Baltimore.
Hi, thank you for having me on the show.
And welcome
to
have you.
Well, I think to understand a case like this, it's important that we not focus overly much on the particulars of what led up to the specific shooting itself. I mean, people are very quick to point to, particular kinds of things that the suspect did or that the officer did that, like, made a bad situation worse. But I think to understand the real meaning of it, we need to look at the broader pattern of police violence overall. And we need to look at not just this incident or that incident, but we need to look at how this institution functions, and how it functions not just, in this city this particular year, but in – in the country as a whole. And if we look at the broad effect of police violence, what we see is that the police, by their own reporting, use violence more often and at higher levels and with more fatal consequences than any violence that they ever face. So the police tend to use violence more often than violence is used against them. And the violence that the police use tends to target the people who are most powerless in our society. So it tends to be the poor, and it tends to be people of color. And that's not really coincidental. I think that if we consider the history of this institution and the way that it's evolved over the last couple hundred years, those are exactly the populations that the police are charged with controlling. And therefore, it makes sense that that is where violence is going to be, where the violence of the police is going to be most concentrated.
Let me open the phones. I have listeners joining in. 410-319-8888, Burness, on the west side of Baltimore. You're on the air.
Hello?
Hi, Burness. You're on the air.
Yeah, Ernest.
Ernest, yeah. I'm sorry. Said Burness on my screen. I apologize.
That's all right. You have to remember that Guglielmi is not a sworn police officer. He's a spokesperson.
Right.
He's never on a scene when an incident occurs. He looks at the reports that the police make and got together to make, and then he comes out with a spokesperson. He's not going to testify in any court because he wasn't on the scene. He wasn't there at the time of the action. So most of the things that Guglielmi is saying, it's just talk. He doesn't have any experience in it. Now, the only way that you're going to stop these police shootings is have an outside agency like the FBI, hopefully, that their charge is to investigate and prosecute police officers if they did something wrong. Now, Justin Fenton said, well, they're afraid that they're going to get the guns taken out of their holster. So Justin Fenton doesn't even realize that they have a holster now that they put in effect several years ago, that it's very difficult for a person to disarm a police by taking his gun out of the holster. The holster is made so it's very difficult and it's a special way that the police has to take the gun out of the holster. Now, as far as what happened in that house with that vacant house, first of all, the police don't have to go in a vacant house. They can either send a canine dog in, or they could use a small grenade, gas. It's like the size of a tennis ball. If a person is in there, you can throw that grenade in there, and he's coming out no matter what. And he's coming out, and he's not going to be offensive when he come out. He's going to be trying to catch his breath. But once the police is in a house like that, and it's a one-on-one, two police in there, if they shoot the guy, they know if they don't come up with a story that they're going to be charged criminally. So they'll bring out a knife that they had in a plastic bag, and they might even put a small cut on a person. A small slash.
Let me ask you, Ernest, let me quickly before I answer this question. You're a retired police officer.
Right.
Have you seen the things you say happen?
Well, I know that they happen. And you can see that they happen just by paying attention to the news. I mean, it's in the news every day. In New York, where they shot this guy, Amadou Diallo, 59 times, and he was reaching for a wallet. I mean, you don't have to... then they sodomized the guy with a stick and put it up their rectum. And in Detroit, they took a flashlight and beat a guy to death. But see, in cases where they had a prosecutor like in Detroit, it was a female prosecutor. She was determined and bound that she was going to send those police to jail. Her name escapes me right now.
So,
she sent them to jail. And after that, there was no more police shootings. There was no more brutality or things of this nature.
So I just want to get to respond to what you were saying, because we have like four guests here, and Anthony and I have four guests here, and we have like 13 minutes left in this hour. Lakeisha's on the line as well. But, and Ernest, you always bring these interesting perspectives as a former officer when you call in. So I'm curious, Justin. Let me start with you, and just you heard what Ernest was saying, and I'm just curious about your response to it, and what even officers or other officials are saying about other ways of addressing this, and we're addressing it.
Well, I mean, first of all, the thing I said about the holster was you know, that's what the police union says. So I'm not being an apologist for the department here. I'm just sort of giving all sides of the issue. But you know, I'm only aware of one incident where sort of the in recent years where the sort of the facts you know they came out one way publicly on the news. You know, we asked for documents later and found a much different story, and that was the shooting of a gentleman in Northwest Baltimore where he was an informant, and he called the officers there to say that there was a guy in his porch with a gun. When the officers showed up, that guy pulled the gun on the officers, and they shot back, firing and killing the informant, not the guy with the gun. Now, it was presented that
yeah, we had that one, too.
Died. I'm sorry?
We had that one, too.
Yeah. Office. So, I mean, you know, but as far as the other ones, I mean, I'm sort of hesitant to presume that officers want to kill people and are planting evidence to cover it up. I think that most of these are, you know, unfortunate situations that get out of hand, and I think that there's a lack of training options or you know, sort of thinking through the officers' heads about how else to get out of it. And it's really tough to second-guess those things. That's not to say that they can't do better and that people shouldn't lose loved ones when they call 911 for help with a schizophrenic episode.
So, Dwight?
No, I think Ernest was, and we don't agree on everything, but on this one, he's right on point. I mean, and there needs to be some type of oversight, particularly by the federal prosecutor's office, because they have jurisdiction. When you're talking about violation of civil rights, it's not just always because we think of it in terms of black and white, but in terms of violation of persons' civil rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. We bring these police cases under a civil rights statute, be it federal or be it state. And so we do need this type of oversight. You know, when Giuliani was talking, he mentioned another one of our cases, the Brown case where the Marine was shot 13 times. And he says, well, Mr. Bernstein prosecuted that. Well, doggone it, how are you not going to prosecute somebody, shoot somebody 13 times that's unarmed? So, I mean, that is obvious. But as Ernest said, he's not, you know, he's a spokesperson, so he does not really aware of a lot of the facts that take place. But, yeah, this goes back to you need oversight in order to have accountability.
And, Christian, I'm just curious, again, from your perspective, because you see it in a different light. I'm curious how you think this other communities are, if they are addressing it and resolving it, or any communities in America are resolving this issue.
I don't think it's being resolved very well anywhere. The police as an institution has done a very good job of insulating itself from any sort of accountability or any sort of consequence for its actions. I mean, over the course of the 20th century and now into the 21st, it's the history of the evolution of this institution is very much a history of its developing autonomy and it increasingly acting independently of considerations of the law or considerations of the political interests of City Hall, and instead pursuing its own sort of institutional logic. Now, the reason that it's allowed to continue on that course is because on the whole, it more or less does the kind of thing that powerful people want it to do. And in a way, it even benefits the authorities who are nominally in charge of the police not to have too much control over them, because if they had that control, then they'd be responsible for what the cops do. And as it happens, in a highly stratified society like we live in, it requires a certain amount of violence in order to preserve that inequality. People with power know that, and they're willing to allow for a certain amount of embarrassment and outrage, according to the most extreme examples, in order to let the institution continue in the way that it's been set up to continue.
Let me go to the phones here and we'll turn to Ted Sutton, because I think this phone call has to do with something he was raising earlier. 410-319-8888. Lakeisha, you're on the air.
Good evening, everyone.
Good evening,
Thank you very much for taking my call.
Thanks for being patient and waiting.
Not a problem. I actually think that situations like or shows like you're having this evening are very helpful. I think a lot of times it's just a lack of communication. Like I have a friend who was a Baltimore City police officer. and we were just having a dialogue. And I asked, I said, you know, I'm a female. I'm not very intimidating, I don't think. So if I get pulled over and an officer has his hand on his weapon, it's very intimidating to me, and I don't know what's about to happen. And he said, well, on his side of it, he said, I just want to get home. I just want to get home. I want to make sure I go to the next, get to the next day. And I don't know what's waiting for me in a car when I pull somebody over, so I have to be ready at all times. And then on the flip side of it, I was telling him about times I get pulled over, and even though I know I'm not doing wrong, I get very nervous because of the incidents I read about in the newspaper. Like, you know, if I'm on a dark road and it's just me, I get very nervous even though I've done nothing wrong. So storms like this where we could just have open dialogue. I know police officers have other things to do, but maybe if maybe once a quarter or something, the public can get together without necessarily bashing the police, and the police can come without being accusatory towards the public, and to just have an open dialogue about little things like that, it'll make a big difference, and it can maybe start to dispel some of the distrust in our communities with police officers, because I believe 99% of police officers are doing a great job. They don't want to harm anybody. Anybody willing to put their lives on the line for complete strangers, have my utmost respect. But with every profession, there are some people who do abuse. It's just, unfortunately, in their profession, very public, and lives are at stake. So that's all.
Lakeisha, thanks so much. And to let you jump in on this, I mean, one of the things that we had on the air here that happened a few weeks back when one of our leading community activists, Heber Brown, was on the air with Bob Cherry, who's the president of Turner Police here in Baltimore, is they agreed to bring online police officers into the studio to have a conversation with community activists.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something I think would begin – that would be a good thing to do. Also, the question of just pushing for a strong civilian review board, more control over the police, better training, is what the Hopkins Leadership Program has been talking about, all issues here. But go ahead, Ted.
Yeah, actually, one of the things that I am concerned about – because, see – we don't want to get off the track. It's not about bashing any officers. There are some good officers out there. Major Russell is doing a dynamic job over on the east side, and Major Delgado, and Commissioner Bielfeld. He knows the work that I'm actually doing out there in the streets.
Former Commissioner Bielfeld.
You know, yes. But one of the problems that I do have with that is we have to get away from that us against them mentality. And there are a lot of officers that are coming in, and they have heard about Baltimore. And they've seen the wire, or they've seen the corner, and a lot of people have this stigma that it's very dangerous here. And when you have this mentality, you may not focus on the protecting and serving as much as the policing part. And when I'm talking to a lot of so it's on both sides. It's fair when a young male was being pulled over, and I said you don't. It's hard for people to understand. If you don't ride past a police officer and look in your rearview mirror to see if he's coming behind you or pulling out to come behind you, then you haven't had this experience. See, I see other people, and they may come out and they start fussing. No, you know, I can't believe this is absurd, you know. But a lot of people, they don't even consider their rights. They just say, I'm happy to just get away. I just want them to let me go. And so they don't even deal with their rights. But we have to get away with that. And I'll be honest with you. I really just that I was in fear for my life. If you are being trained and this is your job, see, I'm out there in the prisons and working on the corners and working with gang members every day. A lot of them are armed. There's no way I'm not fear for my life. But my thing is, if you were in fear for your life, do you have mace? Do you have a flashlight? Do you have a baton? Do you have a taser? Do you have a partner? Do you have a radio to call backup? Now, some of these things should have been an option, as opposed to when I look at that video and that young man that got shot down in front of Lexington Market. And actually, I talked to some friends of the man who was just killed. And they was in tears. This man is harmless. The words they used, they said, this man is harmless. They even went to high school with him. So when I talk to the people in the community, I get a different side from what they – and so we have to get away from this us against them and make it the policing to protect and serve. That's what has to go back, because we'll be sitting on a powder keg if they feel that they can continue to do this and get away with it.
And I think one of the things that we're missing, when you're talking about shootings, you're talking about the ultimate sanction in terms of deadly force.
Right.
What about all the other things? That's what's creating this volcano within the community, all these other beatings and illegal stops. And when we had all the illegal arrests in Baltimore City, it was just like open season on the public, and you justify it. The public accepts it because crime is rampant, and people say, well, do whatever you got to do. And so you just begin to trample rights. I won't even talk about the calls that we get in terms of beatings and in terms of breaking in houses without search warrants and throwing people on the floor and 90-year-old women, grandmothers and so forth. And I'm talking about people that have called me in the last 2 months, guns stuck to the head and guns put to the head of the children and carrying young men out into Howard County and taking their shoes and socks off, or arresting a 7-year-old boy on a bicycle and taking him to the police station and chaining him to the bench. All of those type of cases short of death. You know, the public doesn't even really hear about 90% of those. And so we only hear about the ultimate sanction. But all these other things are going on. Something is totally wrong in the Baltimore City Police Department that has to be corrected at the top.
We have just a minute left, literally a minute left, where we have to take a break for the next program coming up behind us. So, Justin, I'd like to get a final quick thought from you and Christian, if we can, as well.
Well, my final thought is that, you know, this is something that we're looking into. I have a story that's going to run this week. I mean, I think the most interesting thing for me is the mental health aspect. I mean, again, as I said earlier, in the past, a lot of these were sort of confrontations between an armed person, you know, someone who held up a store or was seen with a gun, and, you know, there was some sort of police interaction in the chase. But this year there's been a very the strong majority of these have been someone with a mental illness who a relative or someone else has called for help. And it's ended very, very badly. And so we're going to try to look into that a little bit more and see what the gulf is there.
And Christian, we'll have you back on again soon, but give us a final 30-second thought.
I just want to echo what the gentleman twice before me said, that it's not, we can't just focus entirely on the fatalities. That's just the most obvious symptom of a much bigger problem, and that there's the whole system of violence and of humiliation and the way that the police impose on the community that built up resentment it can't just be a matter of looking at the most extreme uses of that violence. We need to look at the violence in the regular and the everyday as well.
Christian Williams is the author of Our Enemies in Blue, Police and Power in America. Before that, Dwight Pettit, defense attorney who represented clients in many lawsuits around town, and one of our renowned lawyers, Justin Fenton, crime reporter for the Baltimore Sun, Ted Sutton, community activist and youth pastor at the Maryland Church of God in Christ. And, of course, my partner in, I suppose, getting crime, but we might get arrested today, Anthony McCarthy. You can hear every Friday here, 5 to 7 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
Folks, we're going to take a break. Thank you all for joining us here today.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you, Anthony.
Good to have you all in the studio. Thank you all so much. We are about to hear Marsha Reeves.
Keep it moving.
Coming up right behind me. And on the way out of here, I remind you that the Mark Steiner Show is made possible in part by the Maryland Mortgage Program, a community-led initiative of the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. If you are a first or second-time home buyer in the state of Maryland looking for a home in Baltimore City, just call 1-800-638-7781. Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our senior producer is Justin Levy. Our producers are Bobby Marvin Holmes, Mark Henry, and Stephanie Mafaronis. Our engineer is Andre Melton. Our theme music is by Walt Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast, and our past shows, hear new additional interviews, find out information about our guests and the work that they do, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. For Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. We'll